Hello, and welcome to our program, Senior Living, brought to you by AL Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center. I'm Chrissy Mernon. During this next half hour, I'm reading articles from AARP, the magazine, here on AL Radio. And we're going with the cover story, Tyler Perry is flying high and enjoying the view. The actor-producer has parlayed his comic character Medea into a stratosphere career as the billionaire head of a studio empire. But with his great success, he says, comes great responsibility, by Harriet Cole. The first time I met Tyler Perry in 2008, what struck me most about his perfectly appointed Atlanta studio were the clocks. Everywhere I looked, I saw them. My team from Ebony Magazine was told that Mr. Perry, everyone in his orbit addresses him formally, was always on time, meaning early, and that we should follow suit. Perry was uber serious that day. I don't recall that he cracked a smile once, which was notable given that he was best known for having created and embodied the comic character Medea, a no-nonsense auntie who'd anchored a run of successful plays and films. Back then, the actor, writer, director, and producer seemed like a man on a mission. Fast forward to this past May, when I ventured back to Atlanta to visit Perry in his latest studio complex, a 330-acre spread that he opened in 2019. Now a certified billionaire, a best-selling author, and the creator of 24 feature films, Perry seemed far more relaxed. He has all kinds of success to buoy him. Along with the blockbuster Medea series, he has written, directed, and produced TV series such as Owns, The Haves, and The Have-Nots, and BET's The Oval. As an actor, he's played everything from an action hero in the 2012 thriller Alex Cross to Colin Powell in the 2018 satire Vice. Long a mega celebrity in the African-American community, Perry is gaining popularity with a broader audience, and his studio provides hundreds of production jobs, as well as opportunities for performers, writers, and directors. Perry, 52, arrived at our interview in a white Hummer. Wearing a sparkling smile, the 6'6" entertainer unfurled himself from the vehicle, strode past my extended hand, and wrapped me in a warm hug. But some things hadn't changed. He was right on time. We talked about the release of his Netflix film, A Jazzman's Blues, as well as the philanthropy for which he is receiving an honorary AARP Purpose Prize award this year. See, we honor Perry's charity below. Fiercely protective of his family's privacy, Perry still talked a bit about his 7-year-old son, Amon, whom he shares with former partner Jella Belkley. But we started by discussing a better-known part of his history, the difficult childhood that inspired his very first play, and the dogged ambition that made it a hit. Your success began with black audiences who packed Chitlin Circuit theaters in the 2000s to see your touring plays. Why did you choose that route instead of striking out for Broadway or Hollywood? I grew up in Louisiana, and my mother grew up in the Jim Crow South. She didn't have a healthy trust of white people. Because of the things she had endured, horrific things, she wanted me to know the value I had within me. I never felt like I needed to look outside of my own race for success. I knew that if I mined what was in our community, what I had in me, it would work. You've talked about growing up with an abusive, alcoholic father in an area rife with poverty and despair. So many people aren't able to escape that kind of environment. Why do you think you were able to get out? I have some survivor's guilt about that because there are a lot of people I went to school with who did not make it, who ended up in prison, who ended up murdered, especially during the time of the crack cocaine infusion into America. I credit my getting out to my mother, my aunts, my grandmother, all these incredible women who prayed and taught me things and believed in me. Had I not had their examples and their straight-up backbone, their insistence that I make something of myself, I don't know where I'd be. You hit bottom before any of this success was within your reach. Can you take us into that moment? It was the early 90s here in Atlanta. I had this dream of being a playwright, and I had written a play called I Know I've Been Changed, which was about child abuse survivors and the power of prayer. I was working as a bill collector, and I had saved $12,000. I spent all my money to put this play up, and it didn't work. I lost it all. After that, I tried again many, many times to produce the play. I would get different jobs between those times, but I'd quit to work on the play, and I ended up homeless. For 3 months, I lived in a Geo Metro that I was hiding from the repo man. The despair, the suicidal thoughts, the overwhelming feeling of not wanting to live in that kind of moment, that was real. And yet you never gave up, and the play succeeded. That never give up thing came from my mother and my aunts and the ministers and preachers in my family. I can trace the preachers back to slavery. My great-great-great-great-grandfather was a minister. That faith is in my DNA. How did you get from that moment to this one? The seed was planted when I was 9 or 10 years old. My father was a subcontractor. He came home one day and was happy because he had made $800 building a house. But he told me that the white man who owned the house later sold it for $80,000. That didn't make sense to me. I wanted to be the owner of the house. You're a big proponent of ownership, especially of your intellectual property. How did you maintain that ownership once you started working in Hollywood? I was able to make some incredible deals by allowing people to underestimate me. I always played it small, listened to what they had to say, and made the deal. I'd say, well, I've got to own it. They'd say, oh, okay, whatever. They didn't think that my first film, 2005's Diary of a Mad Black Woman, which debuted at number one, was going to amount to much. But the support I had from the audience that knew me, those voices, those standing ovations, gave me the confidence to understand that it's a blessing to be hidden. And you now employ many people? Thousands of people come through the gate every day to work here. And it's a beautiful thing. A lot of them are former prisoners who wouldn't have had this shot. Your studio is housed in a historic location. Can you tell me about that? The land itself was once a Confederate Army base, which meant there were people here fighting to keep my ancestors enslaved. From the moment I walked onto the property, I was haunted by it. Sometimes when I'm walking here at night, I get a chill from all the things that have happened here. So as we built each of the 12 sound stages, we buried Bibles underneath them as a way of refocusing the spirit of the place. I wanted this to be a place where everyone was welcome. You have given a lot of black actors a chance or a second chance. Your roster includes Taraji P. Henson, Viola Davis, Idris Elba, and then there's Cicely Tyson. I've never said this publicly, but I took care of Miss Tyson for the last 15 years of her life. She was a proud woman, and the only reason I mention this is because she wrote it in her book. This woman had done so many amazing things, but she wasn't well compensated for it. She made $6,000 for Sounder, you know. I wanted to make sure she knew that there were people who valued her. So she did one day of work on my 2007 film, Why Did I Get Married? I paid her $1 million. I loved working with her, and it makes me feel great that I was in a position to give this incredible woman some security in her latter years. Oprah Winfrey is a godmother to your son, and she was your business partner during your collaboration on the Oprah Winfrey Network, OWN. When she was struggling with her network, I said, I can help you. Finally, she said, let's see what you can do. I brought scripted material to the network with the crime drama series The Haves and the Have-Nots. It ran for 8 seasons and is still the highest rated show that was ever on the channel. For Oprah and me, it was important to show black people that you can work together, that powers can come together and be successful. Every time I talk to a black man who has a son, I ask, how do you protect your child? What do you teach your child about becoming a man? I haven't had the conversation with Amon because he's only 7, and I want to hold out as long as I can. I don't want to tell him that there are people who will judge him because of the color of his skin, because right now he's in a school with every race, and all these kids are in their purest form. When he describes his friends, he never defines them by race. So the moment he loses that innocence is going to be a very, very sad day for me. I know it's coming, though, because he's already asking some really tough questions. What I want him to be, more than anything, is somebody who sees injustice, speaks out against it, and affects change. Your mother, Maxine, passed away in 2009. You've told stories about the way she and her girlfriends would talk when they got together and the way humor was a kind of anesthetic for her pain. I'd watch them play cards on Friday nights. There would be so much laughter in the room. I didn't know it at the time, but I was in a comedy masterclass watching all of those women. Tell me about forgiving your father, whom you support but don't spend time with. What helped me get to a place where I could forgive him for all the abuses is that I found his life story. It made me understand that we all arrive at a place from somewhere. His childhood was full of abuse. I had an opportunity to either carry that on into another generation or dig it up and cut it at its root. The thing that allows you to get to the root, to really get down in there, to pull that up, that's forgiveness. You are very private about your personal relationships. Why? Because these people are not famous. My son's not famous. I want him to have as normal a life as he can. I want him to know what it's like to have his own name and his own life and not have the pressure of trying to live up to whatever or whoever your father was. And Jalila Belki, your former longtime partner, what would you like to share about her? She's an incredible mother. Jalila runs the Perry Foundation, which has allocated millions of dollars to grassroots charities that benefit children, families, and communities globally. What was your impetus to create the foundation in 2006? When you've been given a lot, you have to do a lot, and the need is great. I've tried to align myself with people who have the same sensibility when it comes to helping others. My mother put it in me. I would wake up in the morning and get out of bed, and I'm stepping on someone who's sleeping on the floor. I'd ask, "Who's that?" And my mom would say, "They needed a place to stay." She didn't have much, but what she did have, she shared. As I do this work, I'm always thinking of her. What advice do you have for people who have a dream like yours? Listen, I would love to say follow my example, but I would never do that. There are no guarantees. You can be as talented as you want to be, and if things don't line up, it's never going to happen. There are many people, way more talented than I am, who didn't make it. I had some grace and some favor from God. I didn't do it all. I just did the work. But I had no other choice than to follow my dream. I had no other strategy. I had one thing, and that was that first play. It had to work. I wasn't going to write another play if that one didn't work. So I had to wait and hope and pray for that to happen. For me, humility stays very present because I remember living in that car. You know, I don't care if I'm on my plane at 40,000 feet in the air. I still remember those moments. And also, I understand that if something goes wrong at 40,000 feet, ain't nobody but gonna help me but God. Who is Tyler Perry today? I'm Maxine's baby. I am defined by everything she put in me. She was the kind of woman who tolerated or accepted nothing but your best. And I'm Amon's father. All of this other stuff is really great, but the thing that gives me motivation every day is being Amon's father. And here's that little sidebar. We honor Perry's charity. AARP is presenting Tyler Perry with an honorary AARP Purpose Prize Award for his leadership of the Perry Foundation, which strives to transform tragedy into triumph by funding a variety of human services and arts organizations. The award honors extraordinary people, 50 and older, who tap into the power of life experience to build a better future for all of us. In July, AARP awarded Purpose Prizes to five other changemakers, as well as Tyler Perry. The next article from AARP, the magazine, good habits that might age you prematurely. When does something healthy become unhealthy? When you do it too much to the exclusion of other choices. Here are five good-for-you habits that could ultimately hurt you, by Leslie Goldman. Like most of us, you've probably been hit over the head for the past few years with the power of habits, the idea that locking in some simple, healthy, everyday behaviors will set you on a course for greater well-being. And there's a lot of truth to that conventional wisdom, but even healthy habits can benefit from a shakeup. When you take the same handful of ostensibly positive actions every day, in and day out, it often means you're missing out on a variety of options and activities that could offer a wider array of benefits. We asked experts in medicine, nutrition, exercise, and more about the healthy habits they wish people would take breaks from, especially those who want to stay in tip-top shape as they graduate from their 50s, 60s, and 70s. 3 anti-aging snacks. Nosh your way younger with this trio of workhorse foods. Almonds, they contain loads of vitamin E, an antioxidant that protects cells from damage. That helps explain why people who eat nuts every day live longer than those who don't. Berries. Whether they're blue, red, or black, berries are loaded with natural jewel-toned pigments called anthocyanins, which are packed with memory-enriching compounds. Greek yogurt. This common staple of the Mediterranean diet offers calcium for strong bones, protein to support muscle, and probiotics that nourish the gut microbiome to help with healthy aging. The habit. 1. You stay out of the sun. Why? It's not as good as you think. Your circadian rhythms are like a clock that keeps nearly every organ and system on a 24-hour cycle. Its strongest signal, sunlight, which tells you to start the day, cues your body to feel awake and energized, and regulates appetite, mood, and more. As the sun sets, your circadian clock releases sleep-promoting hormones. Among sleep's benefits, it cleans your brain of toxic byproducts that build up during the day, says Sarah Mednick, a professor of cognitive science at the University of California, Irvine. But people in their 50s and early 60s spend less than an hour a day on average in sunlight. Do this. At minimum, go outside every morning for 15 to 30 minutes, then again in the late afternoon or evening. Can't get out? Try 15 to 30 minutes in front of a light box at a consistent time early in the morning. The habit? Number 2, you eat nutrition bars. So-called nutrition or energy bars may sound healthy, but many of them are covert sugar bombs that pose as health foods, says Raja Katta, MD, author of GLOW, the Dermatologist's Guide to a Whole Foods Younger Skin Diet. Prepackaged fruit juices and smoothies and healthy breakfast cereals are also high on the list. Many foods that carry a healthy halo can deliver more sugar than a person should eat in an entire day. Excess sugar levels have also been linked to high blood pressure and heart disease. And yes, even the best nutrition bars are still processed foods. Do this. Look at the label and add up the grams of protein and fiber. If the total is higher than the grams of total sugar, your bar is probably healthy, says the authors of AARP's The Whole Body Reset. The habit 3. You drink when you're thirsty. Why, it's not as good as you think. By the time you feel thirsty, you are probably already dehydrated. Our internal mechanisms for triggering thirst become less sensitive as we age. Chronic dehydration can increase our risk for urinary tract infections and may even increase the risk of diabetes as well as colon and bladder cancer, says New York City-based integrative internist Dana G. Cohen, MD. Another issue, if we lose muscle as we age, we lose some ability to store water. You know you're dehydrated if your pee is dark. It should be a light straw color. Or weigh yourself daily. If you weigh less than you did the day before, it's probably water loss. Do this. Drink enough water so that you need to urinate every 2 to 3 hours during the day. Or eat water. Plants are loaded with it, and their fiber helps keep water inside the body for longer periods. The habit 4. You walk every day for exercise. Why it's not as good as you think. Walking is great. It helps maintain strength in your heart, brain, and joints. But with age, people often ditch other workouts because they fear injuries or worry that they're too old to run or lift weights, says Claire Morrow, a senior physical therapist with Hinge Health in San Francisco. As you get older, you lose muscle mass and joint mobility at a faster rate unless you strength train. Without strength training, the average person loses 3 to 8% of their muscle mass per decade after age 30. The rate steepens after 60. Over 70, work on your balance. Try walking backward, for example, 3 times a week. do this. Get at least 150 minutes a week of moderate exercise, brisk walking, water aerobics, or 75 minutes of robust cardio, jogging, swimming, and at least 2 days a week of muscle building activities. The habit 5, you constantly wear supportive shoes. Why it's not as good as you think. Arthritis can make it hard to take off our shoes, but wearing shoes all day deprives our feet of a chance to work. Our toes need to push into the ground to maintain balance, and our foot muscles contract to maintain balance and posture, says Emily Splitchell, a functional podiatrist in Chandler, Arizona. Supportive shoes and insoles do most of the work instead of the feet, and thick soles rob the bottom of our feet of crucial sensory stimulation. Nerves send info back and forth to the brain, helping you keep good posture, stay balanced, and avoid falling. The more you wear shoes, the less your brain practices those skills. Plus, the nerves in our feet start to lose sensitivity in our 40s, requiring more stimulation for the same response. Do this. Go barefoot at least 30 minutes a day, particularly when cleaning and cooking, since your movements are more varied. You're on your toes, bending, lifting, and so on. The next article from AARP Magazine, Real People, Theme Park Titan. Where can she be just like any other kid? Retired builder Gordon Hartman launched a welcoming wonderland for his child and everyone else's. When my daughter Morgan was 12, we were at a pool while on vacation, and she saw some children throwing a ball back and forth. She tried to join them, but Morgan has a significant cognitive delay, and she wasn't able to say, "Hey, can I play?" These were nice kids, but they didn't understand what was going on, so they jumped out of the pool and rushed away from her in fear. I saw Morgan's face fall. All she had wanted to do was play. My wife, Maggie, and I started talking about where we might go that would be welcoming for Morgan. We tried taking her to Disney World, but it was too loud. The crowds were too much. We took her to this place or that place, but nowhere that was really accommodating for someone with special needs. We kept asking each other, where can she be just like any other kid? This was in 2006. I was 41 years old, and I had just sold a group of real estate companies in San Antonio that I'd started building at age 19. I was ready for something new, and I knew how to develop a project from start to finish. I had created a foundation to help people with special needs. Eventually, Maggie and I decided that we would use foundation funds to try to build an inclusive theme park. Not a place for people with disabilities, but a place for everyone. I had no idea whether this new concept would work. Morgan is one of an estimated 49 million people in the United States with some form of disability, and each one is different, like a fingerprint. We had to bring in doctors and therapists and other experts to understand what was needed. I bought some land in town, and I sought donors to join the project. That's how Morgan's Wonderland got started. It now has 26 different attractions, including a train, an off-road adventure ride, and a catch-and-release fishing lake. A lot of times, we were able to make the attractions more welcoming with very simple fixes. For example, on the carousel, we made the turntable flush with the ground so that someone in a wheelchair could get on, and we included two chariots that can accommodate riders in wheelchairs. The chariots go up and down just like every other animal on the carousel. We believe that if you see something you want to do, you ought to be able to do it, not just watch. We've learned from our visitors, too. At first, we thought people who'd come to a place like this would only want to eat healthy food, but we heard different. Now we offer amusement park fare like nachos and cotton candy along with the healthier stuff. The park opened 12 years ago and has welcomed more than 2.3 million visitors. It's a place where families can relax and have fun. We hear a lot of laughter and see a lot of excited dancing. We've also added a water park, a sports facility, and a 102-acre camp with horses, swimming pools, and zip lining. Later this year, we'll be opening a healthcare facility so that people with special challenges can get medical and dental treatment from an environment that works for them. That has opened. It's called the MAC. Morgan is one of an estimated 49 million people in the United States with some form of disability, and each one is different, like a fingerprint. Morgan is 28 years old now, and she loves the park, though she doesn't really understand her role in its creation. To her, it's just a great place to go. Her favorite ride is the swings. She also loves the nachos and asks for them on every visit. Philanthropist and former home builder Gordon Hartman, 58, directs the boards of Morgan's Wonderland, Morgan's Inspiration Island, Morgan's Wonderland Sports, and Morgan's Wonderland Camp in San Antonio, Texas. The next article from Real People, Unstoppable Force, Keeping the Boats Afloat, How Retired Private Investigator Faye Farron Became the Fairy Godmother of New Orleans, and that's F-E-R-R-Y, Fairy Godmother. In 2001, I sold my detective agency in San Francisco and moved to Algiers Point, a quiet New Orleans neighborhood that was a short, free ferry ride from the French Quarter. A lot of my new neighbors worked in the hospitality industry across the river, and they depended on the ferry to get to work. After Hurricane Katrina, the State Transportation Department announced that it would be cutting the ferry's hours, stopping service at 10 p.m. That would have left a lot of restaurant workers unable to get to their shifts. So I decided to rally some neighbors to protest the cuts, and we got the state to back down. That's how our nonprofit, Friends of the Ferry, got started. Fast forward to 2013, and the ferry system itself was on the chopping block due to budget cuts. I just knew it had to be saved. The service had been started in 1827 to connect the two oldest neighborhoods in the city, so it wasn't just a practical way to cross the river, it was our history and our heritage. I started using my detective skills to get access to public records so we could arm ourselves with information. A reporter friend advised me to turn our protest into spectacles. When the news media comes out, she said, public officials come out too. So we protested in crazy costumes, some of us dressed like rubber duckies. I'd wear a midnight blue dress and a tiara, the fairy godmother. It's New Orleans. There are always costumes around. We talked to people about what losing the ferry would mean, how it would increase traffic on the bridges. We went to the state legislature every week for 6 weeks while the issue was being debated. The ferry came within 2 weeks of being completely defunded, which was scary, but in the end, a solution was found. The state turned operations over to the city, which started charging a fee of $2 per ride for everyone over 2 years old, or $1 for seniors and disabled people. And the new management bought new ferry boats. The old one looked like a riverboat and was in bad shape due to deferred maintenance. It rumbled so loud you thought it might explode in the middle of the river. Now the ferry is smaller, silent, and uses so much less gas. It's also faster. It only takes 3 minutes to cross. Being the fairy godmother is an ongoing volunteer job for me. I organize an annual fundraiser for the ferry, and I cook dinner for the crew on Christmas Day. I field dozens of calls a week from people with questions about ferry service, and I'm working with management, activists, and public officials to expand high-speed ferry service in New Orleans. We could be so much more connected. People often run into roadblocks and think, that's it, it's over. But I've learned that as long as you keep trying, you're still in the middle of a process. If you want to win, just keep going. Faye Farron, 73, is the founder and president of the nonprofit Friends of the Ferry in New Orleans. You've been listening to Senior Living on Al Radio. You can listen to Al Radio on our specially tuned radio or by streaming on your computer or smartphone. You may also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at www.alradio.org. Thank you for listening. This program will be replayed after 9 this evening. I'm Chrissy Mernon saying goodbye from Al Radio.